Well, this afternoon, I'm going to, last time I talked about Raghurata, the 16th patriarch, and this time I want to talk about his teacher, the one he had acknowledgement from, Kanadeva, who received his confirmation from, you say Nagarjuna, I say Nagarjuna.
Tomato, potato. Yeah.
And it's an interesting story. You know, Nagarjuna or Nagarjuna is actually considered like the second Buddha, really a substantial guy that had a profound influence on Buddhism. And Madhyamaka. Okay. And quite a guy. And Kanadeva actually didn't study with him. He showed up at an event where Nagarjuna was, or Nagarjuna had traveled to southern India, and Kanadeva is from a merchant class and was into doing these merit blessings and things, but he was also a very astute guy, and Nagarjuna could perceive that. So at their first meeting was the confirmation. So in a way, Kanadeva was like a Pratika Buddha. He had figured it out on his own. And Nagarjuna actually confirmed it. But also part of the story is what I want to touch on first. And so the master Kanadeva was from southern India and belonged to the Vaishya class, and this is from the Cook translation of Transmission of the Light. And it goes on, in the beginning, he sought worldly benefits and enjoyed argument. This is Kanadeva. The venerable Nagarjuna had obtained the way and was in southern India to teach. Many there believed in worldly benefits. When they heard him preach the Dharma, they said, "Worldly benefits are the best thing for people. He speaks pointlessly about Buddha nature. Who can see that?" Nagarjuna replied, "If you want to see Buddha nature, you must get rid of self-pride." In another translation, it says conceit. In order to see our Buddha nature, we must get rid of our conceit, our ego, in that way. Which brings me to the present. I want to talk about a dear friend who struggles with this transmission aspect of practice. She is a Dharma heir. If not now, she is anyway a Dharma heir of Angie. In the Hon Koban lineage. And before she will sow her brown acacia, she said she will sow a rakasu for her little terrier. And she hasn't gotten to that rakasu yet. She, to me, sets the gold standard of what being an Eno is at Sasheen. I have been to many, many Sasheens in California and Minnesota. And she, by far and away, is the best Eno I've ever encountered. And she's married to, I'm going to call him a crazy guy, and I say that in a very positive way. He's an eccentric, phenomenally skilled machinist. He worked in the aerospace industry, building rocket engines, and then left that and just kept machine shop stuff and makes all sorts of contraptions out of brass, gears, pulleys, wheels, motors. He also has a really old Schwinn bicycle from the 20s that has a gasoline engine on it that he fully restored. That's just immaculate. And it made me think of the 100 years ago, your great-grandfather, Joe, that built electric cars and tried to find a market for them, and he was way ahead of his time. So here's this crazy guy. You know, we have solar hot water system here on our, well, it's not a functioning, it doesn't work. So our solar system doesn't work. But my friend's husband makes these planetary systems, these solar systems that do work. These little gears and motors, and they spin. You know, he has these orbs, these brass orbs that are attached, hung, cantilevered over to another system so that, you know, there might be 3 or 5 or 10 of these orbs that rotate around. And he's made at least a dozen of them of various sizes. Just wonderful guy. But back to Donovan. I digress. And her being an Eno. And the heart she puts into being an Eno. When she would be Eno for an ANSI Shishin, there would be almost every seat would be filled. You know, the cushions were almost touching all the way around the room. And the wake-up bell would be at 5:30 in the morning, and she would be up by 5:20 just to make sure that the wake-up bell person, that the alarm went off, that they were okay. Not to reprimand them, but just to make sure that they were okay, that they got their day going. She was up at the coffee table to make sure that whoever had volunteered to do the coffee was there, because she is addicted to coffee, to caffeine. So she needed it, and she was demanded that that be made. And then she would be down here at the Zendo before the person who was going to do the Han was here, just to make sure that the condition of the Zendo was good and that the person who had volunteered to do the Han would show up, and if they didn't, she would do the first Han. And that would wake them up so they had run down. So she would position herself outside the door or in the Kaisando, just kind of off to the side, and she would just stand there. And people would come in, and if they had a question or a problem, they could approach her or not and just go to their seat. And she would check to make sure, you know, people were showing up. And if somebody who usually was here really wasn't here, they would, you know, how's Anne doing? You know, we need to check. Did she have a good night? What's going on? And then she would also tend to the lost souls that would show up. And this particular Sashin, I was one of those lost souls. I had worked all week. I needed to work. I think I was working on a tunnel job. And so I wanted to come to Sashin. So I was here early in the morning. I think it was about the time of the first Han. And there she was. And I could tell that every seat in the Zendo was occupied pretty much with the things that people had, the teacups and their a shawl or the way the cushions were stacked, you could tell that, like, this place was pretty full. So wanting to be considerate to the container of sashin that was here, I quietly approached her, and I bowed, and she bowed back, and I said, "Where would you like me to sit?" She bowed back to me, and she said, "On your butt." So I found myself a seat and sat down on my butt. But that's the kind of Eno she was, with this great sense of humor and deep care and no sense of conceit or pride in the job of being Eno. It was a deep respect that she has about things. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that, in that when we come into the Zendo and we actually deeply respect our own practice and the practice that's here, we sit down in this amazing place with these other people, and to take that core respect and use it in our zazen by respecting each breath we take, to deeply respect each breath we take, results in this deep connection to everything. And breakthrough can happen. And if it's hard, if we're bored, if we can reinvigorate our zazen with this respect, and it's not just self-respect with a small s, it's like a core respect for, like, not just our breath, but even for the dust mites that come into our lungs and the pain in our knees, and we just honor and respect each instant with our full attention. And I think that's what Nagarjuna is talking about there. So that's the first half of my talk. Now on to the story of Kanadeva and the actual acknowledgement that occurred between Nagarjuna and Kanadeva. So I'm going to go to Clary's version of this. And after I read Clary's version, Lance, I'll ask you to read the Mount Shasta version, which is quite different. And maybe people here can help elucidate that. So the meeting between Kanadeva and Nagarjuna. So Kanadeva visited the great master Nagarjuna, knowing he was a man of wisdom. Nagarjuna sent an attendant. So here's Nagarjuna. He sent his attendant out to place a bowl full of water in front of Kanadeva, just as the latter was about to reach the gate. Nagarjuna then watched to see what Kanadeva would do. Kanadeva placed a needle on the surface of the water and brought it to him to meet Nagarjuna. Happily, they had a meeting of the minds. Now, in the Mount Shasta version, it says that Nagarjuna placed the needle in the water.
Yes, he held up a needle which he plunged into the water and then offered the bowl to Kanagaiva. Their eyes met, and Kanagaiva, in great joy, realized that it was an angel.
So it's a kind of a different translation of the circumstance. And in a way, I like Cleary's version because, you know, setting a needle in a bowl of water exhibits a fundamental physical property called the meniscus effect, which I think most people know about. Mm-hmm. It's where the capillary action of water actually supports the needle from sinking. Much like the water bugs on the water use that meniscus effect to walk on water. And so I thought, you know, Kanadeva was a smart guy. He could do a little magic, and they got it. But then in the Cook translation, it's Kanadeva that sticks the needle in the water, and here it's Nagarjuna that puts the needle in the water.
Strange. I mean, that's not a translation issue. Mm-hmm.
It is a translation issue?
It's beyond that. It's a big translation error. Someone made a translation error.
Yeah. So the bowl of water representing the undifferentiated whole and the needle penetrating the water from top to bottom, representing clear penetration. And I'm going to digress again. I have this cousin who's a good writer. She writes fiction stories, but she envisions the story as an orb. Just this orb that contains the whole of the package of the story. All the elements, all the personalities, all the conditions, all the arisings, the circumstances. And she talks about taking a needle and penetrating that orb in many different ways to get all these different perspectives of how the circumstances are. And I think that's a really insightful way to look at all the conditions, that there's many beginning and ending points from which to do that. Now, how that fits into the ultimate context of this big picture and the needle, it might be a slight variation, but I wanted to put that out there. I'm going to stop here, and maybe this is too short a place to stop, but just see what kind of thoughts people have on what's come up so far.
In the 90s, I came to Jokoji for a sesshin, as I had been doing maybe once a year. And there was sort of a disorganized few people around, and one of them told me I was an Eno. Now, I'd never been a sesshin officer before, but I did get a call from Ryan Brandenburg, then the director, who talked at me for 10 minutes trying to tell me what I was supposed to do. I didn't like him too well, so I sort of ignored him. That's the way it went. And this session was another one in which Coben didn't actually show up. although he was scheduled to, and we waited for him, so we had no real teacher, no leader. And it was just fine. We all sat. I would do the bells if nobody else was doing them. Ryan actually took care of the kitchen. It was wonderful. No organization, no orchestrator, nobody with a wit.
Lots of different styles. Lance?
Well, yeah, all the different styles and doctrines. One thing that struck me, it's interesting, I've never read this before, in Nicaragua, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's written in like 14th century, maybe?
Quezon wrote it, say there's 30 years per generation, that would be 90 years, it would be, 1325, would be a guess.
So, in this episode, they mentioned, they had this term Buddha nature, which, that was not a term in use at the time of the person they're talking about. In fact, that didn't come until China, as far as I know, until Zen came about in China. And it's very interesting to me that they're putting it in the ancestor right after Nagarjuna, because one of these doctrinal disputes that probably is more important to scholars and such than it is to practitioners is whether Nagarjuna believed in any kind of ground ultimate existence or whether it's just everything interrelating. So they're putting it there with the disciple of Nagarjuna is very interesting to me. So they're giving Buddha nature a real foothold in to put it with Nagarjuna's disciple. So they're kind of taking a stand, apparently, that this term at least has a fundamental place.
This is G.U. Kenneth putting it in there.
Well, no,
hundreds of years later.
But his version also, they said, Buddha nature.
Enlightened nature.
Not Buddha nature.
No.
Enlightened
nature.
Oh, I thought you said, I must have read it in my own mind. Enlightened nature each time?
Enlightened nature in that one. And
which one is that one?
Cleary's.
And this one now is?
Cook's. Well, that's Cook's, isn't it?
And Cook says Buddha nature.
Yeah. And then yesterday, when you read about Rujing, it didn't occur to me at the time, and then later, it was very fascinating because he kept talking about enlightenment, and he gave him a koan. and this is the person who taught Dogen, and I have heard so much that, there's no attainment, and koans, we don't. And here, Rujing is doing a koan talking about, attaining enlightenment. So it's,
well, many of these stories have a koan at the beginning of them.
Yes, yeah.
Most
of them, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's been kind of eye-opening for me to just, what you think you know, you don't, or to reference Yogi Berra again, in baseball, you don't know nothing.
Yes, David.
As far as I know, the Buddha nature doctrine is connected with the mind only.
Yeah, yoga.
Which actually originated in India.
It evolved out of that. I don't know that they used that term.
I think they did, actually. Oh, I think if you check the teachings of Asanga.
Yeah. Well, that's still much after Nagarjuna.
It's, I think, about 300 or 400 years after that.
Is that the Yogacara school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, because that happened, I thought, pretty quickly after Nagarjuna.
I think I don't know the exact timing, but I don't think it was... I think it was a couple hundred years within that period of time.
When the Mahayana was developing as the mind only. then.
Right.
Okay.
And I know in the Tibetan tradition, these two different types of Mahayana philosophy really have just gone toe to toe for hundreds and hundreds of years, disputing about whether there is an actual, does Buddha nature mean that there is some kind of an actual thingness or a substrate or not?
Well, then maybe reading further on this is appropriate because let me continue with the story here.
Just reflecting that when you're translating old texts like this, I guess you have the liberty to put words in people's mouths.
Oh, yeah. When there's a lot of liberty over and over again.
No problem.
Ji Yu does have a preface where she explained her way of translating.
Oh, yeah.
She's very explicit about certain terminology and
right.
her stylization of the text as well to call out certain terms.
Right.
To call out?
To call out certain terms almost like a shorthand for it,
uh-huh.
you know, rather than to be taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
In Cleary's version here, the circumstance between them, I'm going to read a paragraph and then Nagarjuna's poem. A man of great knowledge among them, Kanadeva visited Nagarjuna, and they ultimately attained accord. Then Nagarjuna shared the teaching seat with Kanadeva, just as Gautama Buddha had done with Kasyapa on Spiritual Mountain. Nagarjuna then expounded the teaching to them by manifesting the form of the full moon. Master Kanadeva said to the crowd, "This is the teacher manifesting the essential form of the enlightened nature to show us. How do we know? Because signless, formless absorption is like the full moon. The meaning of the Buddha nature is wide open clarity." When Kanadeva had finished speaking, the sphere of the full moon disappeared. Reappearing, Nagarjuna spoke the following verse. Body manifests the full moon symbol to represent the body of all Buddhas. The teaching has no shape. Thereby we discern it is not sound or form.
Once they'd heard the superiority of this principle, they completely reverted to their beginner's mind. Among them was the highly perceptive Kanadeva, who sought an audience with Nagarjuna and, as stated above, realized his original nature, that's all in capital letters, in great joy. Following this, Nagarjuna offered his preaching seat to Kanadeva, just as Shakyamuni had shared his half with Makakasho on Vulture Peak. Nagarjuna, whilst remaining seated for his expounding of the teaching, manifested the appearance of the lunar orb. Kanadeva addressed the assembly, saying, "Behold the saintly Nagarjuna. By displaying the form of Buddha nature," again all in capitals, "he points it," capitals, "out for us. How do I know this? Because the samadhi that goes beyond aspects is, in form, like a full moon. And the term Buddha nature signifies that which is utterly clear, pure, and immaculately luminous." After Kanadeva had finished speaking, Nagarjuna concealed the circular form. Kanadeva now took a seat beside Nagarjuna and spoke in verse. His body displayed the form of the perfectly full moon, by means of which the body of the Buddhas is shown. Expounding the Dharma has no fixed shape, but one must still take pains to make clear that it is neither sound nor form. Oh, and it's very different.
What a koan. You don't have to look far.
Yeah, I guess what comes up for me is, what's the point we're supposed to get as students? I mean, reading all about these ancient sages that met and manifested orbs and floated pins and all these kinds of things. What are we supposed to take away from this?
I guess that our Buddha nature is luminous, like a full moon. So we come back to Zazen to discover that. And Sesshin is a great opportunity for that. When we relinquish the extra and return to the core with a pure intention, which I think I use the word respect, and maybe that is has too much to it, but it's an element.
I thought a little bit. This came up yesterday, I think, in Cohen's talk. Everything is intrinsically luminous. Even you know, in describing homage to the pure. Everything is intrinsically pure, from the basic atom on up, and it's just our particular coloration of it that may exclude that, or may not see it.
When I think of that needle in the bowl of clear water, the jewel mirror samadhi comes up, filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding in a heron in a moonlight. Moon in the dewdrop, how can you see other than by contrast? But it's not the empty nature, it's not the form. You need both, but to even call it a both something, you can't even say that. So you can only talk about it indirectly by contrast. And to me, it seems through the ages, from teacher to student, that was the teacher's way of reflecting the student's own Buddha nature. But it took both teacher and student to do that. You can't say, well, we're going to teach just this way. This meets this, and it happens together. It's not one doing it for the other. You need the two. You can't even say manifest. It's so hard to talk about. That's why the Diamond Sutra says, to say X is to say not X, therefore you say X if you acknowledge that everything you say is a lie.
That's right.
Everything you say posits it apart from something else. So if you acknowledge that, you can say what you need to.
In that moment when Kanadeva and Nagarjuna, their minds met as one, and it wasn't as teacher and student or guest and host. It was like, it was an acknowledgement, similar to when Buddha raised the flower and Kāśyapa smiled. And it was that, there was an acknowledgement, there was a meeting that words cannot, they're not helpful. It's that direct connection. Anyone else? Yes, Eric.
In the first story, it talked about, I forget the exact context, but it was talking about the like translation issue between conceit and self-pride. Could you give me context of where that was again in the story?
It's where it's before Nagarjuna and Kanadeva met, but Nagarjuna traveled to South India and was in the area where Kanadeva was and some of the probably people, friends, colleagues, students of Kanadeva were in the area. And Kanadeva was a proponent of worldly blessings, that there are worldly blessings by through merit. And so his followers kind of had that notion that, yes, I work hard so I can get good results, and I give alms so that I'm benefited. And then Nagarjuna showed up and said that fundamentally there is no merit. It's pure Buddha nature. And they said, surely you're joking. And he said, how do you see your Buddha nature? And he said, you give up your conceit. You give up your self-pride.
I don't think those are the same thing, though. Conceit and self-pride aren't the same thing to me.
They're not? How do you see them as different?
The connotation of conceit has this sort of negativity around it, whereas self-pride I view as a positive emotion to cultivate. And I guess just the word choice
in
general.
So pride to you is actually something to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
See, I come from a different school. Mm-hmm. Pride is one of the seven deadly sins. And I've struggled with the whole idea of pride for much of my life. Doug, you should be proud of what you have. It's like, I have deep gratitude for what I have. As far as pride, who am I? It isn't me that made it. It wasn't me that accomplished it. I was an element maybe in some of that happening, but it was much greater than me. And I'll bring up another story. That exhibits this in a way of a lot of times we benefit from the actions of other people, and with a couple peers of mine, had arranged to embark on a journey somewhere of amazing consequence. And there was a discussion around this journey, and the three of us said, yeah, you know, this is what a good idea. And I said, yes, I'm in. Yes, I'm in. So I made an enthusiastic yes, I'm in. And then time went on, and actually there was a lot of preparation that had gone on. One of my peers had actually contacted the facility, had checked out the travel arrangements, checked out the guidelines, checked out the circumstances of what was going to happen and when things were due and when the application was due and how much the money was going to be. And the peer sent out the information to the rest of us, the other two, about these circumstances so we could begin to make arrangements. And so I noted the time that the application was due. I got my application in on time. I typed up my two paragraphs, boom, set it in. Meanwhile, there's more communication going on with the manager of the facility and other aspects, and things get askew because one of my peers' application didn't get in, even though it was sent in, it was lost. So eventually, what ends up happening is there's all this work one of my peers did to help arrange for this whole thing, and my peer got in. I was first alternate. Somebody dropped out, and I got in. So I'd done, I think, four things. I'd said yes to the idea of doing this adventure. I turned in my application. I checked my emails, and I had finally got confirmation, a phone call. You're in, Doug. Are you still going to come? And I said, yes, and I sent in my check. So maybe I did five or six things, whereas my peer had done, over a period of months, had done hours and hours and hours and hours of things. And so I was riding on coattails of these circumstances, and I got in. It was like the easiest thing for me. It was like I was riding a merry-go-round, and there was that gold ring, and bing, I got it. And yet, I did not understand the full conditions of the circumstances. So for me to be prideful about getting that ring, I got it, is very childish. It's very small-minded. And so I see self-pride as something that can contaminate us. Now, that's where I want to use the word respect. And if it is, if you turn pride into respect for the circumstances that are supporting your existence, like your being here is based on the people who built this building that's supporting where you are sitting right now, and the endless meals and childbearing years of the people that helped build this, as well as the people who built the highways so that you could drive in a car that somebody else built and designed to get here. And so that's where a deep gratitude and respect is essential to the core of our practice. And if that is absent from our zazen, then I see basically you're wasting your time. If you want to penetrate to the core, you must acknowledge that each breath is the most magical thing that we got. And if you can connect totally with that, it's not a question about self-respect or respect for others. It's just a core respect that will transform you completely once you get it. And then there's no going back. Yes?
Well, I can see you feel very strongly about it, and you spoke very eloquently. But if I could just defend my colleague here. Words mean different things to different people, how we're brought up and connotations. For you, I can tell there's really something around that word pride.
There is. Yes. I'm a dad with kids, yes, that are in, so.
But aren't you proud of your kids and when they get some wonderful thing? No, have you never said I'm proud of you? They get all A's or they work really hard at something.
I am going to take you to the woodshed, Buster.
Now, It's not pride myself over yourself. It's more akin to the kind of gratitude. Like when we sit, like people will come in and ask, well, what's the big deal about posture? Why are you so, well, I remember a teacher once saying, dignity, you sit with dignity. And I thought, why is that important? I'm just trying to find out about, the nature of existence. Dignity, what does that mean? And it reminded me another, this one. I remember going to a dental hygienist, getting my teeth cleaned. She said, are you proud of your teeth? And so, I'm proud of my teeth. My teeth? Just kind of like you, they were just given to me. I didn't do anything. On the other hand, this one group I sat with at Rahatsu, only once a year at Rahatsu, and the very last evening, late in the evening, they would do this ritual called the inspection of the Buddha body. And the Roshi would walk, it was the last sit of the evening, around, and everyone was to take their best posture, and he would inspect the Buddha body. And it's strange how these things can work, but a number of times, taking this posture and, doing my very best to exhibit the Buddha body, and I would feel riveted that I was the Buddha body, and there was a pride in the glorious sense of pride, an outpouring, and that I'm everything, and a love of everything, and this self-love that all the psychologists are talking about ad nauseum. I don't know, maybe they've gotten tired of that by now, but it used to be like self-esteem is just constantly. So that, just, I know what you're, to me, conceit is I'm above others. Pride doesn't have to have that, but it can spill into that, so.
So capital S, self, pride?
Yeah, so, and you did say self. So, what's the self again? It's, mm-hmm. We're exhibiting, anyway, just, kind of, I mean, I loved your fire. That was incredible.
I was throwing strikes.
I don't want to dance.
Strike after strike.
I don't want to dance.
Did he knock it out of the park for you, Eric?
I rest my case.
I was about to yell, hallelujah, praise the Lord.
Yeah, I got that in before. There was like a huge revival meeting.
All right, thank you, everybody. I think we got, we'll clean up, put stuff away, and then get ready for Tai Chi or yoga.
We can do it inside, is that okay?
Yeah, we've
it's
been doing
warm
it here.
Outside. So. Okay, so we can actually probably just enlarge this into a little bit of a rectangle, but stay more or less on this side of the altar so we can see each other.
We also have the yoga mats here we've been using in the past with that.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, do we have enough for everyone?
Yeah, I think so.
Sure, why not then? In that case, we can move the cushions back to the loss.
Last time I counted, they're only
nine. Like the ghosts?
Oh, that's okay. Many of us don't need one, but those who need one can use them.
Okay.
Cups and food scraps and napkins can go in here. This is our last 2 days.
They won't all fit in there, will
they? We'll see.
They can stack.
Okay, yeah.
Garbage and we'll put them back.